Where There's a Will, the podcast series From a Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.
You're listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life about the mental health system in Ireland. In this six-part series, we ask why our mental health system is so dysfunctional, who is responsible for making change happen, and how we can collectively respond, join the dots, and make things better for all of us. I'm Paula McLaughlin.
And I'm Ciara O'Connor. And in this series, we'll be tackling some tough issues and sharing stories about mental health which may be difficult to hear. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text help to 51444. Or if you just need to talk, you can contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP.
We're going to start at the very beginning with a single person who has started to feel not quite themselves. Maybe he's been struggling, even with little things. Maybe she's become isolated from friends and family, and perhaps it's been going on for a while now. This episode is about what might be the hardest thing they have to do, that moment when they reach out and ask for help. It's in that moment when that person has a spark of hope, the hope that maybe the way they have been feeling is something that can be helped, and it is that first point of contact with the system, which for some amounts to a chat and a prescription. For others, it's a gateway into a much bigger mental health maze. We hear messages every day telling people to open up if they feel depressed or anxious or suicidal. But the story we don't often hear is about what happens when they do that. So let's start there, at that moment of crisis, that point of tension, when they step into the doctor's surgery and gather their thoughts enough to say, "I'm not okay."
I was just like, I remember I was standing on the bus one day going into college and switching between just being incredibly angry with everyone else on the bus for breathing and just thinking no one will notice if I just walk off this bus and just, if I don't show up and I just disappear.
This is Victoria. She's a psychology graduate and she's had several depressive episodes in her life.
You know, if I just walk out and walk to the sea and just keep going. I can actually still picture, I can picture where I was standing on the bus and I was just like, I'm not well. Because I was just genuinely like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this. No one will notice if I just disappear right now. That was the most extreme I ever felt. And I every single year since I was in secondary school, I would always get really down in November and then I'd be okay in Christmas. I would sort of perk up again and then kind of by January, February, I'd be fine again. Whereas that year I went down in November and I just didn't come back up again. It's like an overwhelming feeling. This is the way things are. But then it's almost like the flip side of normally. So normally you're like, well, everything is fine. And there's this tiny little maybe nagging voice that's like, oh, well, you're very bad at that or you're, you know, whereas this was flip side where it was like shouting voice of you shit, you're pointless, everything is awful, nothing's ever getting better. And then this very small little voice of, no, that doesn't seem right. Feeling, I suppose, like a combination of like sad and frustrated and just bad at everything. Really like unsuccessful, like comparing myself to everyone and everything around me and feeling like everyone else was doing so much better. Like, what's the point, you know, of carrying on? You know, what's the point of actually trying? That all kind of came to the point where, as I say, I was standing on the bus and I was like, I'm not okay. I can't go on like this. At that point, despite the fact that I was studying psychology, I really didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to access any help. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. There wasn't really any clear signposts, I guess. Even in college, we had this like signs up everywhere that were like, you know, like feeling bad or, you know, feeling suicidal or whatever, talk to someone. But there wasn't really any indication of who you were supposed to talk to or how you were supposed to go about doing that. I went to my GP because that seems to be the only kind of option. I don't really know what else to do. And that for me is actually probably the hardest part, is that, like, you know, if you have like a chest infection or a broken leg or whatever, that doesn't stop you from seeking medical attention for it. You know, it might stop you walking, but it doesn't stop you telling the doctor, my leg is broken. Whereas if you're really depressed or really anxious, that will stop you from acknowledging you need help. It'll stop you from being able to seek help. It'll make it really, really difficult if you do decide you do actually need help to go from that to talking to someone. It was so, so hard. But then you ask for help and we're told, okay, we can see you in 6 months' time. You know, that's like, that's a massive, massive knock to when you've spent so much time working yourself up to asking. It's so hard. You're not going to ask again. That's just kind of proved everything you believe, that you're not important, you're not worthy of help. Physically walking into a doctor I'd known for my entire life, it was still absolutely terrifying, because in my head, she was going to judge me. She was going to tell me to get out because there was nothing wrong with me and I was just being stupid. And she was going to make me feel even worse. It felt like if I said this to anyone, they'd be like, oh, you're just weak.
They're the thoughts that many people carry into the doctor's surgery with them. And that point that they ask for help, that's the point at which something they've been coping with for a long, long time by themselves has become unmanageable.
People would often walk in and they'd sit down and I'd look at them and they'd look at me and I'd know why they were there before they spoke.
Dr. Kira Kelly, former GP and broadcast journalist, describes what happens when someone walks into her surgery telling her that they are struggling.
You can kind of tell sometimes by looking at somebody if they're having a bad time. They're, you know, they're closed in on themselves. Their body language, very often people sit down and they look hunched in. They look like they're struggling. And they look at you and you look at them. And also you can often see that what they're about to say is hard for them. You sometimes see obvious things, like people can be shaking and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes it's not as obvious as that. But you just look at somebody and you realise when you're actually at the core. And I think we all have this. If we are just even connecting with people socially, sometimes you look at somebody and you get a sense, I know you're saying you're okay, but I don't think you are okay. That would make me anxious. I don't really want to go and tell somebody what's going on in my head. That's private. And very often people will almost instantly, as they start to talk, start crying or start breaking down. It's costing them to sit there and tell you, a stranger. And they're only there because they have to be, because they've been struggling with this. People often say, I've tried this, I've tried that. And I always say, yeah, I know, of course you have. People try everything to pick them. You know, if you could dig yourself out of the hole of depression yourself, you would. Mm-hmm. People try everything before they come through my door and sit in that chair and look at me and say, help me. They try everything. You know, then ideally you can snap out of it is bullshit. You can't. And so people will often have struggled a long time. I would say people would on average sit there and kind of go, I've been having this problem for 6 months. That's an average. So people have been feeling crap for 6 months. If you ever had a really nasty, you know, leg pain or something for six, it wouldn't take you 6 months to come through the door. But with things like that, with the kind of the struggle of psychological or mental health difficulties, people will often take 6 months. And it's a big ask. It's a big ask for people to come through. It's a huge privilege to be in that role, because somebody is trusting you with their most private worries that maybe they haven't told their husband or their wife or their friends or their family. And they're hoping that you will help them. And they can be helped, because there is always life beyond mental health difficulties. And I have seen far too many people over the course of my life who have had really major struggles and major issues and been hospitalised and everything, come out the other side and go on and live a good life and have a good quality of life, to not know that there is life beyond all of it. You can recover, you can be well. It's not a forever situation. But we used to often talk about the hand on the door comment, which is patients go, oh yeah, no, you've sorted out my eczema or some minorish thing. And they're kind of almost making as if to go, but then they're kind of, and they nearly have their hand on the door to leave. And then they go, there was one other thing. And often that the one other thing is the real
core of it, but it's taken them the sort of 15 minutes to work up to telling you, because that's a much harder thing maybe to talk about than to say, I have, you know, a sore leg, or I have, you know, something physical. The building up to disclosing something about your mental health is often a bigger ask for people.
I think it is stigma, because I think stigma is part of what inhibits us to do all sorts of things. But I think there is a stigma there.
I think it is a societal stigma in terms of it being stigmatized. But I also think we're sort of trained socially not to talk about it. So if you meet somebody in the street and they go, hey, Paula, how are you? The chances are, it doesn't matter how you are, you'll go, grand. Yeah, thanks. Great. Yeah, good stuff. And you, and they'll go, yeah, great. Good. Great to see you. And then you'll both move on. You could both be in bits inside, but you don't. So there's a certain dredging up of emotion that has to happen to allow you to express your innermost feelings. And you have to feel safe. You have to feel that it will be received in an okay way. And sometimes it hurts us.
I think it's a very difficult thing to come in and sit down and tell somebody your darkest fears. And I have huge respect for anyone who does.
I sat down with James from Dublin to talk about his depression. James didn't ask for help. He couldn't ask for help until he knew his situation had become very serious.
I slid into what I found out was reactive depression a number of years ago. I went through a particularly bad time in my life. I spiraled downwards and out of control. I became very insular, very angry person. Developed a lot of self-loathing as part of the depression, to a point whereby I didn't want to be me anymore. I didn't want to ask for help because I saw that as part of failing. I should be able to do this on my own. I am capable. Completely reluctant to ask for help, which made things worse. Over time, I just got to a point where my self-loathing was so high that I couldn't stand the guy looking back from the mirror. At that stage, I was living in my parents' house, my old original back bedroom in Dublin, and I just felt like I was drowning. Quite literally, I was sitting in my own room and I couldn't even see forward on my own hand. Everything was black and it literally felt like I was drowning, but I didn't want to surface. And ultimately what stopped me was the realisation that both my daughters were in the house at the time. Acknowledging that I'd gone that far and taking that first step onto that bridge of looking for help. Looking for help can also feel like a fail. Being able to say, right, I've got to do this, was a large step in the right direction.
I had to. I knew I had to, because I was in such a bad space that my behaviour was getting kind of erratic, and I consciously knew I really had to do this. And even my husband was like, no, you have to do this. Even going into the surgery, I just kind of whispered, could I see the doctor today? The doctor, can I see the doctor today? Even just speaking is hard. So I spent like 2 days going over in my head what I was going to say, and then when I walked in there, I don't think I actually said anything. I just kind of sat there and cried. I felt like I was wasting her time, that she had, you know, my doctor had like lots of other patients, lots of other sick people to see, and I was like, I wasn't sick, I was just, you know, wasting her time. And I felt like she would feel the same way.
There's a certain dredging up of emotion that has to happen to allow you to express your innermost feelings. And you have to feel safe. You have to feel that it will be received in an okay way. And sometimes it hurts us. It pains us to talk about something that's painful to us. It's not painful to say, you know, I'm here because I have a skin condition, or I'm here because I have a respiratory condition, or I'm here to get my blood pressure checked. That doesn't cost us. It might make us a bit nervous. Doctors can be a bit intimidating. But that's something that we are okay about saying. To come in and sit down and say, I've been struggling. I can't get out of bed. I don't know how I can go on. I don't know why I feel like this, but I'm not coping. That's a much bigger ask for people. That comes from somewhere much more at your core.
Kira says they probably get about 15 minutes in general practice per patient. But what tends to happen is mental health patients take up a lot more time. So what you'll find is you arrive for your appointment at 1, but you're not seen till 2 or half 2. She says that's because she would have had a patient in who was suicidal that morning.
GPs also say, you need to go and get a counsellor, you need to do this. But the truth of it is, an awful lot of patients, particularly over the last decade, would turn around to you and say, I can't afford that. I don't have the money for that. I don't have the money for 50 quid a week or whatever it might be. And obviously there are free counselling services, and obviously there are reduced fee counselling services, but they're thin enough on the ground. They don't extend to every area of the country. A lot of them would have very long waiting lists. And if you were in a position of crisis personally at the time, being told, oh yeah, maybe in 3 months' time you'll get counselling, or in, you know, 6 weeks' time even you'll get counselling, that's a long time to wait when you're kind of feeling you're coming close to breaking point, or you're literally imploding with whatever's going on for you. Often GPs probably are filling that gap as a kind of a stopgap, and maybe they aren't the exactly right person. Maybe, you know, Joe or Mary or whoever is coming in actually needs a good counsellor, but there's no good counsellor available, or Joe or Mary can't afford a good counsellor. So all they have is the GP, and the GP will often step in. And I would hazard a guess that most people would agree with me who work in the area that that is one of the reasons why antidepressants are used as much as they are, because you do not have the ancillary services there in the way that you should have them. And that means that people don't get the time, don't get the therapy, and end up sometimes being medicated when that may not be the ideal course of action.
I was anticipating a recommendation of counselling and therapy, whereas what she did was prescribe me antidepressants, and there was no mention of anything else. It was literally just, here is some medicine, which I was quite apprehensive about at first. And the way she described it to me was kind, she referred to them as brain vitamins. You know, I knew what all these drugs were, I knew how they worked, I knew what they did. I still was like, ooh, antidepressants, that's a big word, isn't it? That's got a lot of meaning attached to it.
But I ended up being brought to the college doctor, and I was put on Lexapro, a mild antidepressant. It helped, I think. I also saw the college counsellor a couple of times, but one of the issues there was there were not enough resources. The college had one counsellor and something like 9,000 students.
The fact is, many people won't even be offered counselling because there's zero uniformity in availability, so it's a lottery. And GPs are bridging that gap by providing counselling themselves in their overstretched clinics, or occasionally referring to private therapy, alternative therapies or others in an unregulated and hard-to-navigate space. Antidepressants are being used to shore up a system that's basically non-existent or overwhelmed. And GPs are doing their best to make sure someone walks out of their surgery with something rather than an appointment for weeks in the future. But it's now the job of the person who's looking for help to try and steer that ship around, looking for a service they can afford and that might fit what they need. That's if your situation is deemed not to be acute. If you present as more serious, Dr. Kira Kelly explains that it's a referral into the public system, which is to be seen by a consultant psychiatrist.
If you're a GP and you feel that somebody has a mental health issue and it's beyond your capabilities, and you know that even you haven't, you know, good talking with them as much as you can, and even if they're on, as you say, medication, but it's not enough, then you have to look, where do you go from there? The first port of call for a lot of people who would have more significant mental health difficulty is a referral to the local psychiatric service, the local mental health service. So there is the child and adolescent mental health service, and then there's the adult mental health services. So people are referred to them. But I suppose the real truth of that is that there are long waiting times. And also, I suppose it's fair to say the truth of them is not all of them are great. Not all of them are, you know, wonderfully holistic, or not all of them are services that when you send your patient to them, you feel confident that they're going to get wonderful care and treatment.
We have been really great in the last 10, 15 years with awareness campaigns. But the idea that you say to someone, all you have to do is ask, just ask for help, because otherwise all you're doing is hurting people more. Actually worse than them not asking in the first place. Like, building someone up who's so vulnerable and then knocking them down is so detrimental that I actually really have a problem with awareness campaigns where there just isn't the resources available behind them. If you're saying, okay, just ring this number, just ask for help, just, you know, all you have to do is get yourself there, then that really has to be all you have to do. And then everything else has to be there waiting for you.
even for us as GPs, as gatekeepers to the service, the signposting is poor. So the signposting for patients is abysmal, but the signposting for doctors is pretty poor too. So you don't always know where the best services are or what services are available, even in your own community sometimes, because things spring up or the HSE brings out an initiative or something happens that there is something there, but you're not informed. So, and you don't necessarily know. And sometimes you hear things from patients, oh yeah, that service is existing over there. And you're going, all right, that's the first I've known of it. And that's kind of crazy when you think about it. So signposting is abysmal. They're saying that's going to change. And that would be very important. But equally, there's lots of stupid things. Like, for example, where I was working in Wicklow, if you wanted your patient to see a psychologist is a great person for people to see and is a really wonderful help. They're, again, few and far between, long waiting lists. But if you wanted somebody to see a psychologist, some of them we were allowed to refer our patients to. Some of them we had to refer our patient to a psychiatrist to refer to the psychologist. How stupid is that? Do you know what I mean? If I know you need a psychologist, why do I have to refer you to somebody else to rubber stamp that? That just creates delays for the patient. Mm. It creates another barrier because it's a waiting list to see the first person and then they put you on the waiting list for the second person. There's stupid inefficiencies like that in the system. And ultimately, it doesn't benefit. It's not patient-centered because it doesn't benefit people being put on one waiting list to get on another waiting list. That's no good to anybody. I think, truthfully, it has always ever been thus. I don't think the health service is necessarily any worse than it was. I think as long as I've worked in it, and I've been in it for 20 years, we've been talking about the crisis. And so I think you become a bit desensitized to a crisis when you've been in it for 20 years. Mm. I think this is the way it is. Does it need to change? Yes, absolutely. And are we in an epidemic of it? I think anxiety and depression, if we're being very honest, are part of the human condition. I know we say that, you know, some people say, oh, one in two of us, one in four of us. I think all of us at times will struggle with low mood. I certainly will. I don't know if it'll be today or tomorrow, but I will. And I have. And I think that's normal because life is not, we're not metronomes. We don't just tick along like little Duracell bunnies. Do you know what I mean? There's times when we are under pressure. And for some people, they have that kind of, it's within them. They have a tendency towards things like depression. But for some people, it can be reactive where, you know, they were ticking along okay, but then just a shitstorm of things happen in their lives. And the next thing they find themselves going, God, I never saw myself ending up in this position. But you know what? My fiance left me. I lost my home. My dog died. My mother died. And, you know, I fell out with my best friend. And now I'm alone and I'm drinking too much and I'm definitely depressed. Wind back the clock 18 months, I was happy. My life was good. So people end up in positions they don't know, you know, people don't know always what turns their lives are going to take, for good or bad. Sometimes they can be changed for the better, but sometimes they can be changed for the worse. So I think things like depression are part of us. And I think when we sort of put them into a box, I just think they're part of the human condition. Life is hard sometimes. And I think anxiety, I defy you to produce any person to me that hasn't felt anxious at some point. And then it just depends for how long that is. If you know, all of us feel anxious walking into an exam or for an interview. So we feel little pockets of anxiety. But when that starts to spill over and become our daily feeling or our monthly feeling or just how it is, that's an issue. And some people have anxious personalities as well. So I think we need to own mental health difficulties in the same way, you know, we all know what it is to pull a muscle and kind of, we'll all do that. We'll all struggle, you know, and I think we need to be kind to ourselves and to each other because the struggle is real and it's there and so many people have it. So there's just a lack of everything across the board. And then all the support things, the things like being able to prescribe exercise or being able, which is a known benefit in mental health issues, or the ability to, you know, in a timely fashion, hook somebody up with a talking therapy that would be suitable for them. That stuff just doesn't exist. And what do you see? You see people going to the GP, having a rush consultation and ending up on an SSRI medication. And that's what you actually see. So it isn't patient-centric. It is under-resourced. It's lacking at every level of the tiers within it. And it's badly signposted.
Badly signposted for the GP, and even worse for the patient, who often has the onerous task of working around a system even doctors find hard to get around. People are confused, but GPs are none the wiser in some cases. We spoke to Dr. Eddie Murphy, clinical psychologist and mental health expert, about what happens after a GP makes a referral.
So a GP will make a determination, first of all, the nature of the depression and is it warrant a referral to community mental health team? Generally speaking, that could be anything from, depending on the urgency identified by the GP, could be 1 to 4 weeks. But if the person says, you know what, I'm interested in another approach to mental health. I'm interested in going down a therapy approach, such as cognitive behavioural therapy. The person could be waiting anything up to 6 months to 2 years to see a psychologist in that service. That referral would be seen by a consultant psychiatrist as on an admission interview in an outpatient setting and would be more than likely prescribed medication and maybe referred to somebody else on the mental health team if they existed, such as a psychologist, social worker, occupational therapist. It gets even more complex for children. So if you're a child under 18, it's a dual track model whereby children are referred to a primary care psychology service, if that exists. Quite often there's a lot of these shortages or gaps in all these services. Or the alternative is they may be referred to a CAM service. Because of this dual track, I call it a dual track, no track model, because quite often children fall between the stools between CAM services and primary care services.
Eddie describes exactly what kind of a first contact with the system people need. One that's simple. One that has many ways in. One that's welcoming. That's well lit and well signposted.
What we have is almost like Newgrange. There's one point of entry. There's one point of exit. And the light might shine in there once a year. What we really need is a Houston station where you can come in many, many different doors. There are people there to greet you. There are signposts there. And the turf wars that goes on between different services doesn't exist. So if you think of it like a pyramid, the top of the pyramid is for the few and the bottom of the pyramid is for the many. Services need to be configured for many, for the most, for some and for the few. Currently, we have overwhelmed CAM services because we have very poor primary care services. CAM services are secondary services. So our models are so archaic and there's embedded professional groups that make these models pervasive. People make the assumption, let's take suicidal assessment. If you're waiting for a CAMS consultant to make an assessment on a child, it makes the assumption that only one professional can make an appropriate assessment of suicidal risk, the consultant psychiatrist. Whereas we know that no professional group has the monopoly on the prediction of risk around suicide. If you have a single point of entry that's gatekept in such a way that you have such extended queues going back behind it and a lack of access. And access to timely services when people want it creates better opportunities for children, for their families, for adults. We need to think about multiple points of entry where the gatekeeping is minimised and where the accessibility is maximised. Like if you go to your GP with a chest infection, you're looking for antibiotics for your chest infection, ideally your GP will be saying to you, well, actually, no, we've got to let this run its course a bit. The disease model works off a cure model. If you take this, it'll be cured. That works in some parts of medicine, such as surgery. If you have a burst appendix, you need your appendix out, and that's a cure. But when it comes to chronic illnesses or mental health problems, cardiac disease, diabetes, you know, these aren't managed through a cure-based model. And that's the fallacy of sometimes the medical model, that it operates on a cure model. It needs to be a treatment management model for some or a chronic illness model. When it comes to mental health, the biology can be important. And we look at it like the biopsychosocial model. That's really, and we put an emphasis on the psychosocial component.
Like everyone's preconceived notion is that there is a disease and there is a corresponding medicine.
Cure.
Yeah, exactly. But that's not actually the way it works. And that's particularly not the way your brain works. But even just going to the pharmacy and getting this box of tablets made me feel a little better because it felt like I had gotten through the hardest part, which was actually going to someone and admitting there was something wrong with me. I've read a lot of efficacy studies and I know that they don't work for a lot of people. It's kind of a 50-50 shot, really. It's like, generally, if you have if you're sick, you have a chest infection or whatever, and they give you some antibiotics, most of the time, they work and you feel better afterwards. But this was very much a, we'll try and see what happens.
sometimes the fallacy is if you give a medication, my view is if you medication has its role, I'm not saying it doesn't have its role, it's very important in the whole area of psychosis and schizophrenia and bipolar, but in other presentations, such as trauma, I work a lot with trauma. You can't medicate trauma. Individuals need to, you know, go through a whole psychological process around managing the traumas that are in their life.
Something striking is how much GPs are carrying here. When they know the services are overwhelmed, they're the stopgap. And that's not sustainable. GPs need to be much better supported with a range of well-resourced services and clear referral pathways. If I need surgery tomorrow, I don't know what the pathway is. But the doctors do. It's all just set up in the background for me. The doctor knows where to go and when, and I just get a letter in the post with a time and date for the surgery. But the way it's described here is that someone comes in feeling depressed, and some GPs in areas where the services are poor are left scratching their heads wondering what to do or where to send them, trying to make a mental health assessment in a very short period of time, and not having those options there for referral.
GPs are unsung people in this whole process. They too are so frustrated. They tell me they're so frustrated. They're frustrated by the slowness of whether it's the primary care psychology system or the CAM system or the mental health services. They feel powerless, and in a way they used medication because they want to feel they've given something rather than nothing. They're frustrated by the system.
So what might good look like? What kind of a response in an ideal world might we get from our GP in a primary care setting?
Say you go to your GP, like going into Houston Station, and you go to the GP and say, well, I'm struggling now. I think I have depression, I'm really struggling. And the GP might say, well, what you have here is this pathway here is community mental health team, and there's a psychiatrist, psychology and social work and occupational therapy, and you know, there's a lot going on in your life. There's potential, there's some homelessness and some life skills development and some depression, and that could be a good pathway for you. Or, do you know what, here's another pathway here. There's a psychologist in the community there. You know, you're not keen on going down that medication route. Well, why don't you try this for a pathway first? Or, you know what, here's a really good support group here, like Grow or Aware. Or, you know, here's an alternative route again. This is a peer-led pathway where people have been through this before, have experienced this, and this is the type of thing that they do. Here's a computerized program of cognitive behavioral therapy for depression that you can do on your smartphone. Here's a book that you might want to read or something like that. Is there any of them that you fancy? Or, you know, can we look at what other pathway would be helpful for you? If I'm a GP and I prescribe an antidepressant medication, and I think, imagine a tablet in your hand. It's almost like it feels like the control is external to you. The control to your inner life is embedded within a tablet in your hand. Can that tablet control your thoughts? Can it control your actions? Can it control your feelings? It can have an impact on it, but there are other ways to support an individual. And sometimes that's the challenge for the talk therapies, you know, the perception or the placebo is not as immediate as something that, oh, I've had a medication, now I'm going to think and feel better. So people buy into that, you know. It's about changing the narrative about that. It's about choice and giving people choice, giving them access, timely access. I believe in the whole area of one-stop shops. Currently what we have is single stations with single lines, and there's somebody guarding the car park of it, and they won't allow you in there. They'll sort of hunt you down the road and say, no, you're not allowed in here. You have to go to another place. Or if you get in there, then there's someone at the front door of the station telling you you can't come into the station. Then the ticket seller is telling you, maybe you got the wrong place, you got the wrong point, or this place only goes to that place there. And then we get on the train, and we've only one place to go.
The ideal scenario for accessing services would have been somewhere that I could have gone that day, because I had to make an appointment. I had to wait about 3 days, I think, to see my doctor, and seen someone who had a conversation with me, prescribed some antidepressants if they thought I needed them, also said, okay, here is three different options for therapy. Which one do you want? Or based on what you've told me, I think this one might suit you. And here is an appointment for a week's time. But if nobody's kind of checking, okay, is this actually working? If I had been living on my own, like, one of the side effects of SSRIs is suicide. You know, it's listed in the sheet. So if you've gone to a doctor and they say, you know, come back if you have any problems, but you're not fit to come back, there's nobody checking up on that, you know. And if you're not in a situation where you have somebody else checking up on you regularly, that's probably quite dangerous.
Lives have been lost because of the system in Ireland. There's no doubt about that, yeah. Lives have been lost by multi-factors about the system, our attitude to mental health, our stigma and shame. So I want my two boys to grow up into a country that is compassionate, where it's people can access timely services in the appropriate settings should they need it. We're a small society, but we can be a global leader in this. A psychologist is like a detective in a way. You're trying to figure out what are the unique pieces that you can try and put into place to support the person to get to where they want to be their real selves. I believe a lot of people in the world put a front on in the world and their real self is neglected. And if you put a front on the world and your real self is neglected, in that space will become negativity, stress, anxiety, depression, sadness, anger. And if you put your energy into your real self, then you'll start shining in the world. Even though I'm in the system, I'm not disillusioned, because I believe either on an individual contact basis or on an influence basis, advocating in a safe space in a way that says, please, we can do better. We can design this better. We can deliver it better. You know, there are ideas to do that, and it can be done.
If someone gets a harried response, if they meet a tired GP or one who is overworked, this can be make or break. This means that GPs aren't just simple gatekeepers to other help. They can be the people who really make the difference between getting better or retreating and possibly never asking for support again. And it doesn't have to be a lottery. If there was a standard practice where there was a clear referral pathway in every county, then you wouldn't be so dependent on a good GP. It wouldn't be a lottery. There'd be a single, consistent, positive response. You'd arrive into Houston and see lots of train lines. GPs should know exactly where to refer you when, and they should make that call for you, so the hardest part is now over. You'd be guided as to what train might suit you best, and your GP would walk you to the door, and no matter what, your journey would be straightforward, and you'd know the way back if this train wasn't the right one for you. GPs also need a much higher level of training in mental health if 70% of all visits have a psychological angle. If they are to be the sole support for people, they need more tools in their own toolkits to be able to provide a compassionate, empathetic, and human response. People who are in mental health crisis need kindness, they need empathy, a clear pathway, and hope. It really is that simple. So if the doorway into the mental health system is this convoluted, you can imagine how messy it is when you get past that first hurdle. In the next episode, we're going to look at what happens when you go beyond the first port of call, the GP surgery. What the system in Ireland is like, its culture, its models and practices. How it has been built up over the years. And we'll also find out firsthand what the experience is like trying to navigate a way through these services. We'll look at possibilities for small and big changes which could make a big difference. Next week on Where There's a Will.
Thanks for listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review us on iTunes, or just tell a friend about us. Also, we want to hear from you. Have you had experiences with the system, good or bad, that you'd like to share? Or have you ideas on how we can make things better, easier and faster for people to get help? Send us a short voice recording to editor@alustforlife.com, or just record a WhatsApp voice note and text it to 083-119-0269. That's 083-119-0269.
And just as a reminder, if you have been affected by any of the issues raised by this podcast, there is help available. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444. If you just need to talk, you can also contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP. Check out alustforlife.com for contact information for all of the support available.
Where There's a Will, the podcast series from A Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.